It's partly our fault because we talk the wrong language and we sometimes let ourselves down very badly. But actually, underneath the failure of individual politicians or inadequacy or failure to deliver is the real world. And you've seen it in Northern Ireland with replacing the bomb by the ballot paper. And it is really crucial. It's politics that saves us from totalitarianism. And it should have been politics that got the credit for saving the world from the complete meltdown with the global finance collapse and what happened with the banks. But unfortunately, politicians didn't tell what was the public what was going on, didn't make the case, and ended up in the UK anyway with the allowances scandal. So we managed to do ourselves in just at the moment when we should have been riding high.
And what do you think it is then? If something, if this this subject matter, politics, affects our lives so dramatically, why can't we get more of the country interested in it?
I think people are interested when they're fighting to get the vote, when they're fighting to be allowed to speak freely, when they're fighting to actually have a voice. And when we get it, we start to take it for granted and people start to become disillusioned. Now, I understand about disillusionment. I understand that people get fed up when politicians are talking about pasties and they're going on about who borrowed a horse from the Met Police when actually they're interested in, can I keep my job? Can I get a job? What's happening to me house? You know, is my family falling apart? All of those things matter to people. And that's why we have to blame ourselves sometimes for the way in which we get engaged in entirely the wrong things. But underneath that is the real world of everyday decision making.
How much do you think Labour were to blame, David, honestly now, for the financial situation we're in? They should have saved more for a rainy day, their critics will say, and they should have prepared us better for this. Tighter regulation on the bankers.
Well, on the last one, I think we'd have to plead guilty. The twist in this, of course, as with so much in life, because it's messy, is that all our opponents were accusing us of being over-regulators. We got to the point, I think, where we got too jumpy, too frightened about that, where we actually were beginning to think, well, we better not, what was called interfere in business, and government were told to keep their hands off. And we made a mistake. We should have not listened to that. We should have listened to the very few voices who were saying, hang on, this boom can't last. On the spending front,
But just on
well,
that, David, sorry.
yeah.
That was a government then that was too weak, that didn't realise the power that it actually had.
Oh, I think there's some truth in that. I don't think we, from 97 onwards, we were so amazed at the majority we got. We were so worried about those 18 years out of power and a lot going back much further than that, where we were always being accused of interfering, of being over-regulated, you know, too much central government. I think we got mesmerised by the idea that we had to prove over and over again that we weren't that sort of
And
government.
yet the likes of Blair and Alistair Campbell at his side, they exuded power. That was the
Well, they
perception.
exuded confidence. They exuded the ability to play on the world stage and to be fair to Tony. Northern Ireland's a good example of someone who got no political accolades whatsoever, but kept at it and at it and at it. And people just need to sometimes just remember that, you know, that there were things going on that weren't for political kudos, they were because somebody cared.
But was it not for, in this massive issue of the economy, David, is a lot of this not laid then at Tony Blair's door, that he didn't use the power that he did have? That's about leadership.
Well, did he know what was going to happen? Of course not. Did he get, if you like, in too interested in global politics? Well, you could make a case. I mean, I think that what he did on climate change, on world debt, was very good. People will have terrific arguments about the question of world peace and Iraq and what's happening now in Afghanistan. He did play his global role way beyond the power of a small country off the two small countries, if you count Northern Ireland as well, off the coast of Europe.
You mentioned Iraq there. Where do you stand on that now, looking back?
Well, I'm probably one of the very few who say, given the evidence, given the situation, given what everybody was thinking and saying at the time, I would vote the same way again. So I haven't reneged on this, not because it was a terrible mess about whether there was weapons of mass destruction, but because everyone, including the United Nations Security Council, back in November of 2002, actually believed that Saddam Hussein had those weapons.
But you got it wrong.
But he didn't. Well, the United Nations laid down a resolution on the 7th of November. People say, oh, God, don't let's go through all this again. But they did lay down terms to Saddam Hussein, and he ignored them. And everybody thought, including the countries that signed up to that resolution, that he had the power. He didn't. And we were wrong in believing that he did have. I don't think we were wrong in taking him out. I think we made a terrible mess of the aftermath.
And how much do you think Blair is damaged by it?
Oh, in terms of his reputation, very badly. I mean, Tony's got inner confidence. I saw him, actually, a few days ago. You know, the work he's doing in Rwanda and Sierra Leone, as well as the Middle East, and of course the money he's making and putting into his Faith Foundation is keeping him going.
But how damaged was his reputation?
Well, temporarily, I think it was. I think in the greater good of looking back, and history will be written about these times, I think he'll be seen as having been an extremely able, strong leader for 10 years.
Yeah, you're intensely loyal to him, David, but
I am, because I knew him and know him and believed that he did his best. And like all of us, we fail on occasions. That's the great weakness and strength of democracy, that we are like everyone else listening today. We have our strengths and weaknesses.
What are your weaknesses?
Oh, my weaknesses are being quite short-tempered with people and not actually... when I was in government, not being mindful of how my cabinet colleagues would see my drive to get things done now rather than in 2 years, 3 years' time, my refusal to take no for an answer. So pig-headedness is one of my weaknesses.
And how did that short-temperedness manifest itself? Would you have shouted at your assistants, or what would you have done?
Well, actually, I was quite good with those who were closest to me. I was worse with those who I ought to have understood might get their own back at some point in time. And I didn't shout. I used to get extremely aggravated with incompetence and inefficiency in the civil service. And I think they had to put up with quite a lot from me. But on the other hand, that's what I was there for. I was speaking on behalf of the people, both of my constituency and of the country as a whole. And that's why when people used to say, oh, goodness me, you're not speaking like a traditional Home Secretary, I used to say, thank God for that. I'm speaking the language of the people I meet in the street and in my advice surgery, and they wanted action. And I tried to do that.
And did any of them cut you any slack, David, because you're blind?
No, they didn't. I mean, in my early days, people were quite bewildered. You know, can this guy do the job? Is he going to be on top of it? I mean, my answer to that was probably to damage my own private life and enjoyment, because I spent far, far too much time in the early days proving to myself as well as to other people that I was on top of the facts. So I'd be working late into the night, all day Sunday, making sure that nobody could outwit me in terms of the statistics. And that probably overdid it to the point where, thank goodness, in the end, people forgot that I couldn't see, and they used to say things that illustrated that pretty starkly.
It's got to make it more difficult, though.
In terms of keeping on top of the material, having to spend a lot more time reading, because you can't speed read in Braille or on tape. I can speed up the cassette machines I use. I've got a mechanism to do that until it almost sounds like Mickey Mouse. But even then, you're not able to just cast your eye down a page or pick up a particular headline. You've got to read the damn lot. And there's advantages in that, in the sense that I pick things up that others didn't, but it's pretty grinding.
And at any time in your life, in the early years, were you angry that you were blind?
I was frustrated. I was angry when I couldn't necessarily do something and relied on someone else. And I gradually began to understand that life is a two-way street. I could do things for other people, and they could do things for me.
You see,
And
I think if
we
it was
both
me,
got something out of it.
I think if it was me, David, I'd be saying to myself, why me? I feel hard done by here.
Well, very occasionally, but I've got some wonderful family and friends, and do you know, they say to me, oh, for God's sake, you know, maybe one of my sons would say, for God's sake, Dad, stop feeling sorry for yourself, or you've got all the wonders in the world at your disposal. And do you know, I have. I'm very, very lucky.
Were you born blind?
Yes, I was. It took them a few weeks to recognize that I wasn't following visually where people were, or smiling back when they were smiling. And then they started to investigate, and then they found out that I couldn't see. I've always been able to see light and dark, but I get it wrong sometimes. So I think that little bit of tiny, tiny bit of sight's probably deteriorated over the years.
So you don't know what a smile looks like.
No, but I try. But what's interesting about smiles is that babies pick them up very quickly from other people, but there must be something instinctive, because I smile, and I actually like smiling. It comes from inside you, and when a smile comes from inside you, it's not a politician's smile for a photograph. It's a genuine, this is a wonderful world.
What a lovely way of putting it, David. What a lovely, beautiful way of putting it. You've thrown me there because it's just beautiful what you've just said. What do you think Tony Blair looks like?
Well, I picked up signals. What you get is you get a picture from other people. I get this from people describing the countryside to me, and trees in the autumn and things of that sort. And you put a photo pit together, really. So I've got him that he's losing his hair. I've got him that he's got a slightly over artificial tan. I've got him that he's kept himself extremely fit, and he's a bit taller than me.
You clearly have to have a strength, an inner strength, to do what you've done. You spent a total of 6 years going to evening classes and day release classes to get the qualifications that you needed to get into university. And I guess you had to call upon that strength, David, when you had achieved your dream, your goal of being a cabinet minister, and then you were in trouble and the pressure was on.
Yes, I did. In fact, looking back to 2004, 2005, I'm not entirely sure now how I withstood it, because this was a terrible combination of the personal and the political. I was fighting to retain contact and responsibility for my child. I was in the public arena. I couldn't say things because we spent 9 months through the family court, so there was lots of things that I was not able to say. And it took me, ooh, I think, 3 years to clear the decks and to get apologies and damages and all sorts of things from newspapers who, as we know now, were up to no good.
And this was the 2004 saga around your nanny and a visa application.
Yeah, well, it wasn't my nanny, but there was an allegation, so that people, just to remind them, that I'd interfered and fast-tracked a visa for the
Yeah, so your
nanny who was
partner's
looking
nanny,
after my,
yeah.
yeah, and I hadn't, and it wasn't proved, but it was so messy that I went to Tony and said, look, I'm going to have to stand down.
How down did you get?
I got very down. Alistair Campbell's talked about mental health problems and the pressures he had before he came into helping Tony. I didn't quite get as bad as that, but in retrospect, looking back, I was probably in very close to clinical depression. You're bound to be when you've lost what you cared about personally, at least temporarily, and you'd lost your job.
But then, David, it happened to you a second time.
Yeah, that was, you know,
So you're, you
that
know,
was
you're.
a no, that was just absolutely one of those. I've written my diaries called the Blunkett Tapes, and I've laid out in there not my truth, but the reflections of the permanent secretary to the cabinet.
And I don't. I'm not asking to go over it all again. I just. I guess I'm just trying to say, you know, one of those life defining moments when you're beat and you have to walk out of the job you love and you stand up on your feet and you get the strength to stand up again. That happens again.
Yeah.
And hard, if you were close to clinical depression hard, the first
hard,
time...
Hard to think about.
What was it like the second time?
The second time I thought, sod it. I've had enough of this. I'm fed up with lies being told about me. I'm in danger of damaging the government. I'll get out. I mean, thinking back, would have been a lot better if I'd not come back in, because that wouldn't have given the press the opportunity to tell the lies that they told.
You see, for a man of principle like yourself, and you've had your phone hacked and you got damages and all that kind of stuff, there will be people on the left that would see you working for Murdoch, and that's what you're doing in an advisory role, as treachery.
Well, they would, but you've got to believe that writing for the Times or the Sunday Times is treachery, and I think that's just a nonsense.
But you're ultimately working for him, David.
Oh, well, I'm very clear, and have been, about the wrongdoing of those who worked for News International, no question about that. And I don't have to like or appreciate Rupert Murdoch, but I do think that what they're doing on... volunteering and working with the Prince's Trust and Fairbridge, which is what I'm working with them on, and education projects, is a good thing. And if it helps to restore their standing, so be it. But if it helps other people, as with all major companies, it's very hard to do anything with a major company without finding something rotten about them, is the truth of the world.
Do you think Murdoch is a fit and proper person to own a newspaper?
Well, Ofcom are examining that in terms of B Sky B.
But in terms of and proper person,
well,
could you stand up and say,
well, let's see what Ofcom say.
But what do you think?
What do I think? I think he's no worse than many of the other people who own major media outlets across the world, including those who own... soft porn outfits. And once you start on this, I'm afraid you'd have to deal with all the others as well.
What do you think should happen then in this time of introspection to the media and how the media finds a story?
I think the criminal prosecution should be brought forward as quickly as possible, because there's been criminality and that should be rooted out. I think once Leveson reports, we should have a proper balance between privacy and the freedom of the press. Above all, we should address the future, and the future is about how we deal with electronic media. The print media is dying on its feet. It's a question of how we deal with those aspects of communication and transmission that are nothing to do with printing papers.
What does your future hold? What are your dreams and aspirations for life, David?
I'd like to make a major contribution both at national level and internationally on the voluntary front. I've got a project going to get a mass volunteer program off the ground for young people who've got nothing, to give them a life. And I'd very much like to be able to continue writing and speaking and making a contribution to the future success of the Labour Party.
What about back in government?
Well, we've got 3 years to try and get somewhere near to winning the next general election. And between now and then, I've got some big decisions to make with boundary changes and all sorts of things taking place here on the in the British mainland. And to be honest, I've got a good 3 years of being able to talk to my family and friends about that.
But the zest, you couldn't rule it out.
The zest is still there. Thanks very much indeed.
David, thank you so much.
You're welcome.